Introducing Under Armour's Infinity High Sports Bra. Its ergonomic design is molded to support the natural movement of your body. With cord-out padding, the better breathability eliminates extra bulk without sacrificing support. And quick-dry padding is Under Armour's fastest-drying padding yet. When you're lifting heavy, running fast, and pushing yourself further than ever before, you need a bra that will help you go that extra mile and make you feel your best. Shop the Infinity High Sports Bra now at UA.com.
Jeep Freedom Days are here, where right now, well-qualified returning FCA lessees get a low-mileage lease on the 2022 Grand Cherokee WK Laredo E4x4 for $369 a month for 36 months with $3,799 due at signing. Tax, title, license extra. No security deposit required. Call 1-888-925-JEEP for details. Requires dealer contribution, a lease across or capital. Lessee is responsible for termination fees. Current lease must end by 7/3/23. Extra charge for miles over 30,000. Residency restrictions apply. Take delivery by 7/5/22. Jeep is a registered trademark.
All right. Welcome back, my friends. Welcome back to the Benzinga Cannabis Hour. I am your favorite chubby Benzinga host, Patrick Lane. And this is my colleague, my cohort, the best of us over here, Mr. Javier Haas. Hello, sir. Doing?
I usually do this on while I'm on camera. And today we have the original guy who used this in every picture as a guest, so I feel a little bit of a, you
know, a little homage happening here.
I rarely think about it because, it, you know, down where I'm from, it means something else, which we won't get into. But it's, you know, a little victory and whatnot. But Steve, who is our guest, uses this symbol for everything, for pictures. I even have a pin he gave me once in Colombia. That's the little hand with the peace sign.
Very
so
cool.
We'll ask him about that now that I come to think about it.
Yes. Well, we've got a cool show today. I'm excited about this.
We had a cool show.
The man himself, Steve D'Angelo, is up first. I cannot wait to talk to Steve. After that, we've got Bob Hoban, who I think everyone in this industry knows and knows well. We'll hear what's going on with Bob. And then Christine De La Rosa from the People's Dispensary. Really, really cool show today.
Indeed. So our first guest, as you said, is Steve D'Angelo. Steve is a very, 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 very famous activist in cannabis. He's been around for decades. He was one of the first to actually open a legal dispensary. Many call him the father of legal cannabis or of the cannabis industry. But guess what? We're not here to discuss that today. Today, we're going to discuss social justice and his related projects. So, Aaron, let's bring Steve on.
Let's do it. Steve, welcome over, my friend. Welcome over. There he is. Yes, look at the peace sign. Yes. I love it. Now, where are you today, sir?
Wait, let me see if I can unmute you.
Oh, yeah. We need to yeah, there we go.
There we go. Yeah, peace and love through cannabis.
Indeed, sir. Indeed. And where are you? Where are you calling us from today?
I am calling you from high in the hills of Oakland, California.
Oh, that sounds so good right now. I should ask you, how is the crazy wildfire situation going out there right now?
It's calmed down here. Last week it was these really angry red skies. It was apocalyptic and scary. But there's a beautiful sunny day here. And I remember again why I moved out here.
That's awesome, man. That is awesome. I used to live in San Francisco for a while, and I was getting all these pictures from my friends in the city, you know, off whatever hill they're on there in San Francisco. And it just, this weird haze, this reddish haze, it looked like something out of a sci-fi film. Very, very strange.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad they're passed for the moment though. Everybody who's in the cannabis community is helping a little bit to start rolling back that kind of climate change. So
amen to that.
I saw this remarkable video the other day that my friend Doug Fine put together, and mm-hmm. it was a hemp field, and the temperature was 102 degrees outside of the hemp field. Inside the hemp field, it was in the 80s. And this is when there were fires going. It was in Oregon, and there were fires going, smoke mm-hmm. up in the sky. No smoke in the hemp field. Those plants were already sucking the carbon in.
No, it's wow. crazy. It's crazy that you mentioned that. I think, you know, hemp is one of your favorite topics as, you know, as a whole, from what I've heard and seen of you in the last several years. And it's interesting to see or consider it as a way to actually reverse climate change for people watching who don't know, hemp, and on top of having many, 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 many uses, is what we call carbon negative, meaning it replenishes to the soil more carbon than it takes from it. And I mean, so again, it takes carbon from the earth and replenishes it into the soil, right?
In a really remarkable way. So for every hectare of hemp that we harvest, we sequester 22 tons of atmospheric carbon. If we make hempcrete out of that, harvested hemp, then the hempcrete, as it dries, will sequester additional carbon. And once harvested, that industrial hemp crop can be used to produce anything that's currently made from cotton or petroleum or trees. So in my view, a hemp-based economy and a plant-based diet are the two most immediate changes that we can all make in our lives in order to forestall climate change.
Wow. No, that's really cool. And I think especially with where we are as an industry and how we're moving forward, I would imagine some of these topics, which, you know, I mean, some might say they're mainstream. I don't think they're mainstream enough. If we still have half the country or so that we're still trying to educate on a daily basis about, you know, whether or not this is real, and whether or not if someone in a very high seat of power in this government tends to say, oh, don't worry, it's going to get colder in a couple months. And that tends to just refute all these years and effort of scientists. So certainly agree with you there. And couldn't agree more that ideally it becomes more mainstream and we can keep this party going, so to speak. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, it will become more mainstream, right? We now have not just a million or two, but tens of millions of Americans who are feeling the flames licking at their houses, who have the water from the hurricanes in their living room, right? Whose kids can't breathe because they've got asthma from the air pollution. So, the question is whether we wake up quickly enough. And I just saw today that a clock has been installed in Times Square in New York. That's a countdown. And right now that clock reads 7 years, some odd days, some odd minutes, and some odd seconds. And it's going down second by second. So, you know, when I think about the promise of hemp, I ask myself, you know, there are hundreds of millions of cannabis consumers all around the world right now. Hundreds of millions. Nobody knows how many hundreds of millions, but hundreds of millions. Mm-hmm. What would happen if all of us converted our wardrobes, not all of them, just 50% of our wardrobes, to hemp in the course of the next year? That is a significant change that we, the cannabis community, could make that would have a measurable impact on climate change and would set an example for other people to follow. So, you know, these things, there's things that we can do right now. Often, I don't know about other folks, but you know, it's sometimes you feel powerless, right? But we have these things. We can wear hemp clothes. We can eat hemp foods. We can start driving this hemp economy forward just with our own actions, the hundreds of millions of us that there are.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Javier, go ahead, man, if you had something to follow up with.
Super interesting. Natan Poniman, another Benzinga writer, and I were speaking with Steve last week for an article that was published in Latin America's leading financial newspaper. It was in print, and it was about the potential of hemp for construction and textiles. And after that article came out, one of the countries in Latin America, one of the ministries, called us to a meeting for us to explain, you know, the potential of hemp, like industrial hemp, for their economy. And one of the things I found were books from the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s, before hemp was made illegal, where we looked at the crops and the production, and we know so much about it. We just stopped doing it overnight, right? We were making hemp clothing and plastics and materials, and we just stopped overnight. And it's crazy because, you know, this government was asking, like, how do we go at this futuristic industry? And I was like, go to your books from the 1920s and you'll find how many kilograms of seeds you need per hectare, you know, or square mile or whatever, in each region of the country. You'll find which varieties work best, right? And suddenly we stopped doing that. And, you know, Steve, why? Why was it? Because, you know, hemp is non-intoxicating. It's not like you can smoke it and be high. So what were the powers, you know, behind that?
So, you know, for thousands and thousands of years, at least, I mean, probably since we were actually even human beings in our modern form, we have been growing and using this plant and carrying it all over the world because it is so infinitely useful for so many different things. One day, this period of time, the last 100 years or so, by the time the history is written, will be looked upon as this bizarre aberration in human history when we willingly divorced ourselves from the most valuable plant on the planet and instead used all of these toxic, horrible, extractive materials to make the things that we need to sustain ourselves. Why did it change? There's a number of different reasons that it changed. One of them was that roughly 100 years ago, there was a absolutely vicious campaign, a racist campaign in the United States, not just to prohibit cannabis, but to demonize cannabis and to associate cannabis with criminality, with psychosis, with depravity, with moral weakness. So that was part of it. Again, it had nothing to do with the plant. It was all about the fact that in the United States at that time, cannabis was being used mainly by Black and brown people. So it was a system of racial control. We also see that during that same period of time, we saw the rise of companies like the DuPont Chemical Company, whose fortunes depend on a continued economy which relies on extraction for its raw material. So it's very interesting at this time in American history and a little bit before it, there was a big debate going on between two schools of economic development. One was called the International School. The International School said, America's all grown up now. We have an army. We can go to other countries. We should go to those countries. We should secure the raw materials they have there, send those raw materials back to the United States where they can be produced into manufactured goods, which we'll sell to the countries that we took the raw material from. The other school, the Comergist, said, we shouldn't go invading a bunch of other countries. We shouldn't be building up huge armies because we can power all of our factories and all of our workshops from the crops that are grown on American farms. Henry Ford was a proponent of the Comergist school of thought. He produced a experimental diesel car in 1940, whose body was made of bioplastic, including hemp plastic, that was 10 times stronger than steel. There's this great picture of Henry picking up a great big sledgehammer and whacking the car with it, right? So hemp was an impediment to the industries that wanted to depend on extraction. And then there was just actually, you know, what I would call the normal explanation for it, absent any of the politics and demonization, maybe an accident of history. Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin before a really good processing machine was invented for hemp. And that changed the economies such that cotton became much less expensive than hemp and gradually replaced it as a textile and as an industrial fiber. That problem is solved now. There's really great hemp decorticators that have been developed and better ones are coming on the market all the time. So that accident of history has happily been resolved and nothing stands in the way of a modern hemp industry now except our imaginations, our willpower, our hands to craft this raw material into a new world.
No kidding. And our faux moral obligations, right? It's very funny to see this and to hear the history behind it, right? There was very clearly a time at which we just said, oh, no, we can't do that, right? And the aberration that you're talking about is, ideally, it ends very, very soon. Go ahead, Steve.
The reason it swept all around the world from the United States was because the main architect of this horror show was a guy named Harry Anslinger. And Anslinger was the first commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. If anybody would like to know how evil he is, just Google Harry Anslinger quote and read a few of the things that the guy actually said.
Anyway.
Finally, he was like one of the longest serving bureaucrats in the federal government. He's just a really clever bureaucratic maneuvering guy, right? But finally, the Kennedy administration manages to basically muscle him out of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. And then they send him over to the United Nations, where he gets busy taking this extraordinarily toxic form of cannabis prohibition that we have here in the United States, deeply imbued with racism, and pushes it all around the world. And so you saw countries that had long, long traditions of hemp cultivation who were basically forced by the United States to close down those industries, which is why when I started getting into the hemp industry in the late 1980s, I had to go to Eastern Europe. I had to go behind the Iron Curtain because there, this replacement had not happened. It was the only place that I could find other than China, which is another story, that had actually the ability to grow and make hemp goods. So it's incredible that we've divorced ourselves from this plant, but hopefully, you know, we will learn a lot of lessons about ourselves as human beings and how to organize our societies in the unraveling of it. It's really quite a remarkable thing that because of ignorance and superstition and racism, we have denied ourselves this most valuable resource and replaced it with resources which are obviously leading to a mass extinction event, probably including human beings, if we don't make a turn somewhere along the way.
So let's take that a step further, Steve. I know this is one of the things that we're here to talk about today, but that unraveling that still needs to happen. It's not just about the faux moral compass that should guide us all away from the hemp plant and the cannabis sector totally, but really it's also about how we treat our own citizens, right? So let's talk a little bit about what the Last Prisoner Project is doing and how we got ourselves into this horrific situation of mass incarceration, specifically and almost exclusively affecting Black and brown U.S. citizens.
That's crazy to put it that way. How do we need to do this? It's ridiculous that we need to have the Last Prisoner Project. We do, unfortunately. So, but it's a good point.
It's tragic, right? So for those of the audience that aren't familiar with LPP, we are a nonprofit organization founded a year ago with a very simple mission. That's to make sure that as this legal cannabis industry is built all around the world, that people who are currently sitting in prison for selling cannabis, doing exactly the same thing, are released. And you would think that this would be a standard part of all cannabis reform legislation. If we as a society have decided that cannabis should no longer be illegal, that it should not have been made illegal, then on what basis can we justify continuing to punish people for something we don't think should be illegal? So the whole idea that there's continued cannabis prisoners is completely absurd when you look at it from a logical point of view. And so LPP is committed to seeing the release of every single cannabis prisoner on this planet and making sure that they have the resources they need to build the lives that were stolen from them and their families. And we do this in a variety of different ways. We have had some successes. I can report that last week, Phil Long, Chuang, forgive me if I garbled the pronunciation there, Phil Long. But Phil Long was a 57-year-old father of two, came to this country as a refugee from the war in Vietnam. In 2015, was sentenced to 87 months in federal prison for cannabis, conspiracy to distribute cannabis in the city of Oakland. And I would note that at that time I was selling cannabis in the city of Oakland and nobody was coming after me. So we, LPP, working with the Goodwin Law Firm, managed to get Phil Long released on a compassionate release program that's in effect in the federal prisons. We're also really working hard to make sure that once people get out of prison, they have some training, some housing, some jobs, so they're not forced into circumstances that may lead them back to prison. So that's essentially what we do with the Last Prisoner Project. Not many Americans realize it, but we incarcerate a larger proportion of our population, and in fact, in absolute numbers, a larger number of human beings than any country on earth. Yes, including China, North Korea, Russia, et cetera. 5% of the world's population, we have 25% of the world's prisoners. That's a travesty in the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Yeah. Not to mention the skew, right? Because also what a percentage of those people are black and brown, or, you know, black and Latino, or whatever you want to call it.
Almost overwhelmingly, 87% of cannabis prisoners in the U.S. federal prison system are people of color.
Ridiculous. Do you want to go a little bit into Radio Free Cannabis? We have your logo there. You know, we've been distributing it through Benzinga. Benzinga is also a partner of LPP. So, you know, this is a big family, as you call it, the tribe.
The tribe.
I love that. I love tribe. That.
So, Radio Free Cannabis is a podcast. It drops every Sunday. It's on all of the usual platforms. We recommend using YouTube because on YouTube, we're translated into 195 different languages. And the idea for Radio Free Cannabis came out of my travels last year. I got to spend 200 days on the road going around and visiting cannabis scenes and economies like all over the world, multiple.
Oh, you in a few of those. We met in Jamaica. We met in Colombia. We met, I think, was it Uruguay or Chile too?
Yeah, I did make Chile. Chile was a few years ago for me. But you, I'm sure you can relate to this, right? What happened is that you go to most of these big conferences and 80-90% of the people who are there are coming there because they want to make money. And many of them don't even consume cannabis or know much about it, really. There's always this core of like 10 or 20% of people who actually have a real personal relationship with the plant. And it's like, we can look at each other and see it in our eyes, right? And we link up with each other really quickly. And I was struck at how easily and how quickly we got along with each other, how comfortable I felt with the folks that I was meeting who were different races, spoke different languages, different spiritual paths, different educational levels. But we all liked to go to the same places and we liked the same kinds of food. We grooved on the same kind of music when we were talking about politics or culture or personal experiences. There was just this commonality. And when I left this group of people, my heart hurt. I mean, I was like, oh my God, I really miss my tribe. And so I'm asking myself, why? Where does this intensity of connection come from? And I realized that no matter where we come from, what our race, our nationality, religion, educational level, social status, anything, we've all had the same set of experiences with cannabis. And those experiences have taught us a common set of lessons. And out of those common lessons, we have developed a shared value system. Wherever we are around the world, we praise and honor creativity. We don't think conformity is that important. We praise and we honor individual freedom We don't think that government authority is nearly as important as making sure that people are free. We honor and respect Mother Nature. We seek nonviolent ways of resolving conflict. We try in our personal lifestyles to adopt habits that are going to help save this planet. We believe in peace over war and love over hate. And that's who we are, no matter where we are around the world. And there are now hundreds of millions of us. Collectively, we're larger than all but the very largest nations on Earth. And in that scope, in that diversity, in that size, the fact that we span the globe is immense latent power. Like I was talking about before, what would happen if all of us just made 50% of our wardrobe hemp? If we can learn how to recognize each other, if we can learn how to talk to each other, despite all of our different languages, and we can learn how to reason and ultimately learn how to act as one, we can change this planet. We can move from this death-dealing economy to a life-affirming economy. We can move towards having children that have a future looking forward to of a world that's getting cleaner instead of a world that's getting more toxic. I think all of that is in our hands. And so, you know, I've called this thing the One Tribe concept, and Radio Free Cannabis exists basically to introduce us to each other and get this show on the road, man.
I love that. Well, Steve, listen, I could talk to you all day, man. It's like literally the godfather of the industry. You can tell this guy knows the history. You know all the stories. I feel like we should host a show with just Steve telling stories.
Oh yeah.
I bet you have a wealth of knowledge, sir, that we probably don't even have the time or resources.
Please don't make stories.
We're reeling you in, my friend. Well, listen, in the brief time that we've got left, I want to encourage everybody to reach out to Governor Whitmer about Michael Thompson. That is very important to us, especially here in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And then Steve, how do people get a hold of you? How do they get involved?
So let's focus on Michael for just a second. Michael Thompson is the longest serving nonviolent prisoner in Michigan prisons. We have had an extraordinarily robust campaign to free him. The Attorney General of Michigan has endorsed that campaign. The prosecutor's mm-hmm. office in Flint, which originally prosecuted Michael, has endorsed his release. And yet, the Michigan Parole Board is dragging its feet. They have again delayed a hearing on Michael's release. And it's just simply unacceptable. Michael is 69 years old. COVID is present in the prisons that he's incarcerated in. He already caught it once, and it's time for him to come home. So if anybody, all of your viewers, anybody within the range of my voice right now, if you go to the LPP website, you guys will probably put the information up here. Call that parole board. You know what? It's really remarkable. If they can't answer, there's an answering machine. And if you leave a message, they'll really call you back. So call them up and have a chat with them and tell them how important it is to you that Michael be released.
Love that, Steve.
Staying in touch with me is easy. Just stevedeangelo.com is the website, @stevedeangelo on Instagram. Steve.D'Angelo on Twitter. I'm pretty easy to find, and look forward to linking up with anybody who would like to do that.
Thank you for joining us. And you know, next up is a good friend of yours as well, who shares many of your ideas, many of your values, and many of the fights we all fight. So be sure to stick around.
Yeah, all right. Thank you, Steve. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you very soon, I'm sure.
Thank you. See you soon.
See you soon, Steve. And so for those of you, we'll jump right ahead. We'll go ahead and move our next guest over. But you can catch Steve speaking at our next conference, the last one that we're going to do of this year, on October 15th. Steve's going to talk about, and I wish we could have gotten into it. He's going to talk about socially responsible investing, you know.
With another one of the coolest people in cannabis, Tahira Rahmatullah.
Stop it.
That's going to be fun.
Now, listen, I can't crush on Tahira right now because Bob is here and Bob is the man. Bob, how are you in Denver today? Where are you?
I'm in Denver, Colorado today. Yes, sir. We are right downtown at the headquarters of the Hoban Law Group. Exciting to be with you guys.
Bob Hoban, You've been around this industry. You're the OG in the industry. I feel like whenever we talk about law, whenever we talk about company formation, somehow Bob Hoban is attached to most of these stories. I'd love for you to just take a minute, Bob, and just give our audience a little flavor of your story, man.
Well, first of all, talk about OGs. Steve is an OG. Steve is the godfather, as you point out. So we simply came in and after folks like that have taken risks and paved the way. But my story begins, my introduction to this as an industry was my mother was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 2005. And many folks have heard this story. And in 2005, my mother lived in New Jersey, where I'm born and from, born and raised in Southern New Jersey outside of Philadelphia. And my children were very young at the time. So I decided to move my mother out here to Colorado when she was told she had 6 months to live with pancreatic cancer. And we bought a condo and I began to see the toll in just the first several weeks on what the impact of those heavy opioids could have on a human being undergoing chemotherapy and going through that whole protocol. And it was really a catch-22. It was the idea of in the morning, I would drive by the condo and I'd make my mother breakfast and give her this regimen of pills. Well, more days than not, she couldn't keep the pills down because she couldn't eat anything. And you can't eat anything when you just feel like crap. So it was this constant cycle. And, you know, being no stranger to cannabis and also understanding that my mother would never do anything that was ever even borderline illegal, quite literally, not even to save her life. We began to explore things under our Colorado's medical marijuana program. Well, there weren't dispensaries at the time. My mother was never going to smoke a thing. You know, to the day she died, she wouldn't smoke anything. She wouldn't inhale anything. And I wasn't about to make her cookies or brownies. I've been down that road. That would not have been the experience for a cancer patient. But we began to reach out to caregivers. There were caregiver networks. And some of those folks came out with, hey, man, meet me at 7-Eleven. I've got the best stuff in town. Duly noted, but let's move on to the next one. Let's look at how we can talk to somebody that's made an oil or a tincture or a food product. The efficacy or the consistency of which was always questionable in the early days. So that helped my mother a great deal. My mother, I'm proud to say, lived for 3.5 years, for the better part of three of those years, no opioid use at all. Now that led me to changing from a large law firm practice into leaving that firm and starting my own firm and devoting that practice to the cannabis industry, working with some of the first operators of dispensaries here in Colorado, operating under the same program in multiple states around the country, then being exposed to something that you may have heard, may or may not have heard of this thing. It's called CBD. The world seems to have this sort of insatiable demand for it now, but at that point in time in 2009, 2010, not a lot of people knew, the people that knew Steve D'Angelo and folks like that knew, but not a lot of folks outside of, small groups understood what CBD or other non-psychoactive cannabinoids were. So we began to work in that space, began to expand, and now it's an international marketplace. And that's really, really exciting to be here. When you're talking about working with countries to import and export cannabis-derived materials, it's kind of a dream come true in a certain respect. Although I can tell you, going to law school, I never thought in a million years my law practice would intersect with marijuana, because that always meant being a criminal defense attorney. And not that I didn't want to be a criminal defense attorney, that just was not the path that I was driven to be on. It's exciting that there is now a class of lawyers known as cannabis lawyers, and I'm proud to have been one of, not the, but one of those original members of that group.
Wow, man. Wow. And so the industry experience that you have, I mean, the law practice and the focus for you, has it been litigation? Has it been company formation, M&A? Give us a flavor of maybe just a couple of them, because I'm sure it's everything. But what's been the real focal point for you?
Well, I mean, for me personally, this is what's bittersweet about building a business as a lawyer. It doesn't allow you to be the advocate that you really want to be, engaged with individual clients. So I work personally with about 6 or 7 different clients throughout the course of the year. Most of what I do now is provide them strategy and advice. Just in terms of, you know, general business operations, I've served as executives for dozens of my marijuana and hemp clients, and I'll use the term marijuana not as a slant, but just because that's the legal terminology, right? I view the industry as the cannabis industry, which really has two sides, hemp and marijuana. And I do understand that the stigma attached to that word, but as lawyers, we're somewhat bound to it. So I've served as an executive. I continue to do that. I serve as an interim or acting CEO for a number of different companies. I get them organized. I plot their policy, their strategy, and then help them obtain investment until a certain point. And then usually my last job is to replace myself. Our law firm has six practice areas. We're a full service law firm. We've got regulatory divisions around hemp, around marijuana. We've got a litigation division. We've got a securities and tax division. We've got an intellectual property division. I would postulate that we probably have worked on more intellectual property in this industry than any lawyers in the United States, trademarks and patents. And then finally, our global practice group, which is really a hodgepodge of great lawyers that understand this space and other jurisdictions. That probably has been the most challenging thing in recent years, is finding lawyers in other jurisdictions that you want to work in this space, because when you approach them, they say, cannabis, I'm not a criminal defense attorney. That's not a real industry. And then you start to show them the numbers and walk through it, and they open their eyes, open up. So that's been very challenging, but we've gotten a great roster of folks there. So, but my days are pretty much full of devising acquisition portfolios for our private equity clients and serving in that sort of hybrid advisor and chief executive type role.
It's funny you mentioned the whole marijuana debate, because I get that very often. I use cannabis, marijuana, and weed interchangeably, and people are kind of fine with weed, but when I say marijuana, they go like, it's racist. And I go like, yeah, against who? Latinos? Like, what the hell? Like, let me, like, it's my word. You misuse it and now I can't use it? Nah, uh-uh. But well, so moving on, you one of the things that you do that I think is very, 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 very cool, and this is my personal opinion, of course, but is advise governments, right? From Uruguay to European countries to Southeast Asian countries. Tell us a little bit about that, and I think that weaves into our topic today, which is social justice. But first, sure. Let's talk a little bit about your advisory work in government. What's that like?
Yeah, so that door opened for me in a roundabout way. Believe it or not, early in my legal career, I was dissatisfied with being a lawyer. In the second or third year of my legal career, I said, this is not a path that I really want to be on for the long term. So I went back to school to obtain my PhD in public policy. I never completed my doctorate, but I did finish my coursework at the University of Denver, the University of Colorado at Denver's public policy program. And I always was involved in public policy analysis and political science. And I was able to get a job at the University of Denver. In fact, I'm drinking from wonderful University of Denver mug here, drinking some water. But at the end of the day, the University of Denver program allowed me to teach regulatory programs. And when I started to say, I'm teaching about government regulations, let's talk about the most exciting element of government regulation that I've ever seen. And that is these brand new regulations around 2010, 2011, that started to come out in Colorado and other states. And so then that became, well, you're the cannabis guy. You're the guy that's going to talk about cannabis policy and cannabis regulation. Well, that led to the being involved in this University of Denver pool of experts, which allowed different countries that were coming to Colorado as sort of the hotbed of cannabis activity, and they found me. So I began to work with Uruguay about 5 years ago. Interestingly enough, I taught a two-week course in Uruguay. I took 14 of my Denver students down there with the Catholic University in Montevideo, and we did a joint program. While I was in town, this wasn't even intended. There was a conference at the Legislative Palace in Montevideo, the capital of Uruguay, and there was a conference on Latin American cannabis reform.
Yeah.
That was a coincidence, pure coincidence. I had walked in to this conference with a number of my students, and we stood out amongst this, you know, largely Latin American crowd, because we were loud Americans, and we came in and we walked into this room, and the person that was speaking was a public health official from Costa Rica. And I had consulted with Costa Rican officials and participated in a conference there about 13, 14 months before. And he was shocked as he was talking to see me walk in the room and said, "Mr. Hoban, what are you doing here?" Basically, and broke out of his Spanish presentation. And ultimately, I began to meet a number of officials that opened many, many doors, and then continuing to study this at a high level, looking at this thing objectively. Because I'll tell you, even my students that came into my courses, they'd come in and they'd say, "Well, I don't really know about this topic." And they thought we were just going to talk about smoke and weed, when in reality, as we all do in our jobs in this day and age, we talked about it at a professional level. So I've since then worked with about 35 different countries on their legislation and their secondary regulations. And that's opened up a lot of doors for me personally, but also, and professionally, but also for our clients, which, you know, that's why you do these things. You want to bring the cream of the crop along with you and show the world that this isn't some sort of dumpster fire at all. In fact, to the contrary, most folks in this industry want to work really, really hard and get some things done.
I mean, it's fun, right? People want to work hard because it's awesome.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. No, it's probably the only thing this year that isn't a dumpster fire so far, but, and that's a cool conference. I'm sure, Javier, you'll be keynoting it next year, because God knows you're speaking everywhere these days. But Bob, let's circle the wagons on social justice for a second. I could talk to you all day about investing and where we are in the markets and whether this is the floor or not, but let's circle the wagons on social justice. You know, I would imagine from where you sit and looking at the policies that are being crafted, looking at what markets like Illinois have done, and, you know, Governor Pritzker, Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton over there, and what they've done with expungement and trying to move the ball forward in getting some of these things taken care of. You want to give us some commentary on that? You know, what's important to you in that debate, or really the crafting of that legislation? Just in a couple minutes that we've got left here, man. Yeah. What's your take on that?
I'll do my best to be brief, as brief as I can, as a lawyer from New Jersey. I have to tell you, the social equity component of that it relates to this industry is critically important. And I think it's oftentimes overlooked. And, you know, not to just keep going back to Steve D'Angelo, but look at the Last Prisoner Project, a great example of how we can effectuate justice in some form or fashion in this industry. What about all the people that have been jailed, people that of minority persuasion that have been disproportionately impacted by being jailed for participating in an industry around this plant? And now you've got folks coming into it that get to legally participate. And what about justice for all those folks that had suffered, you know, ill effects from being jailed? When you're jailed for anything, remember, you're not authorized in the United States to obtain student loans from federally backed sources. That's a major, major impediment for people with opportunities going to school and whatnot. Yeah. Now, the idea of social equity from a government program was something I first encountered in California probably about 7 or 8 years ago now. And it was a new concept, because in Colorado, we weren't talking about social equity programs. We were talking about how to regulate and commercialize the industry. And, you know, Colorado is diverse in many ways, but it's not particularly diverse as a place, considering places like California and certainly on the East Coast. So social equity, in fact, Colorado just enacted its social equity program, which begins on January 1st with applications, many, many, many years into a regulated program. So some of the events of the day with social justice and the racial injustice and the BLM movement have placed a lot of emphasis on exactly what needs to be done to try to meter some justice in this industry. And we as a firm have always tried to do that. We've enacted a very specific social justice action plan. One of those components was filing an amicus brief in the Washington versus Barr Supreme Court action just a week or so ago, where we hope to at least have some impact to persuade the Supreme Court to take that case. Because if that case were to succeed at the Supreme Court, the relief sought would be to eliminate the cannabis portions of the Controlled Substances Act, which have had such an adverse impact on so many people of Black and brown people across the country and around the world. So it's a critically important piece, but so often overlooked, because everybody's thinking about, how do I make money? And it's not just how do you make money, but it's how do you build a business that soccer moms and public policy officials can look at and say, this should be here as standing next to pizza parlors and, you know, health clinics and so forth and so on. So there's a lot of things going on at one time, but we can't ignore this piece of the puzzle for sure.
Couldn't agree with you more. I mean, you look at cannabis and what they're trying to do with, you know, with some of these larger corporate companies trying to echo models of Apple and Pepsi and Coca-Cola, you know, in the CPG space. And you can't have that kind of brand if you're alienating a large percentage of your audience, right? And those, that percentage that is adversely affected and incarcerated by some of the legal boundaries and hurdles that we have. Bob, I hate to do this, man, because we are just out of time, but we have to have you back. Maybe we should make this a regular thing because, you know, you, Steve, we could do this all day.
Show with less people. You know, we need to go to two guests, right?
Well, it's my pleasure to be with you guys. Keep on doing the great work that you're all doing, particularly with Benzinga, but also, you know, Javier, your articles, your coverage of the industry has been well recognized and it's well deserved. So my pleasure to be here. Happy to participate anytime on any topic. I've always got opinions and things to say. So thank you for your time and it's much appreciated.
Pleasure, Bob. Take care, man.
Bye-bye now.
Wow, God. A wealth of knowledge from those first two guests. And let's keep it rolling. Let's keep it rolling.
Why is it just 1 hour? We're on the internet. We could go on forever.
We could. My 4-year-old might not like that. But listen, we do what we have to do.
We can have her as a guest.
You don't want that. You don't want that. Welcome. As we get our next guest up here. Hello. This is Christine De La Rosa from the People's Dispensary. How are you?
I'm good. How are y'all doing?
Awesome. I mean, how could you not be awesome hanging out with Steve D'Angelo and Bob Hoban and now yourself? I appreciate the lights in the background there. Are those Christmas lights?
Yes, because it's 2020, it's a dumpster fire, and I said, F it. I'm putting up Christmas.
I could not agree more. I could not agree. I love that. I'm actually going to go downstairs and get my stuff out right now.
That's awesome.
Now, where are you calling in from today? Are you in Oregon?
No. So I'm actually in Austin, Texas.
What?
I live in Oakland, California, and one of our stores is in Portland, Oregon.
That's right.
I came down in January of this year to take care of some family business with some ailing parents, and thinking I would be easily able to fly back 3.5 hours to, you know, the Bay, 3.5 hours to Portland, or thinking that I could be back home in 3 months. And then the pandemic hit and I kind of got stuck here because I have, I'm one of those folks that are specifically vulnerable to COVID. So I cannot travel on a plane.
Oh, man.
And I really can't be in groups of people. So I'm one of those people that if you get COVID, you're going to die. That's who I am. So I'm here for a minute, which is not bad. I love Texas. I'm from Texas. My whole family's in Texas. So I'm not mad about it, but I do miss my Bay Area and I do miss being able to go to Portland to check on our stuff there. But luckily,
You're safe from that. You're safe from air pollution right now. It's funny it's not funny that you're stuck in Austin, but it's funny that there's a coincidence here that I was about to fly out to Austin.
I remember this.
South by Southwest. And like 4 hours before I left, like my plane left, they called me to say it was canceled and was going anyways.
I was a panelist at South by Southwest and I was already in Austin, but I remember thinking, how odd. I mean, I went to South by Southwest in the 80s, right? Because I lived here. But I was excited to like experience the new South by Southwest. I hadn't been. And then, you know, then it wasn't anymore.
Tell me about it. We were, you know, I was going there to represent Benzinga, you know, judging a pitch contest. I'm like 30, like a random guy from Argentina. To me, this was like, you know, you know, the pinnacle of success.
Well, when we next can year, fly, come to Austin and I'll show you around.
Please.
Love it. Love
Patrick,
it.
Patrick, you need to join us.
I will join you. Come on. I love Texas. I'm from Kentucky originally. We like to think we're Texas, but we're not. So. we do what we can. So listen, Christine, tell us a little bit before time gets away from us about the People's Dispensary. We'll circle this train back around to social justice and social equity. But I think what is interesting to me is your story, because you have had an interesting an interesting run here. I'd love for you to give our audience a little flavor of that.
Sure. So first of all, it's important to note that we come out of the legacy market. So we started in the legacy market before we moved into the People's Dispensary. But how I started in the legacy market was because I almost died in 2010 when I had a pulmonary embolism because of undiagnosed lupus. And then I spent 5 years and 11 doctors and 11 pills a day plus a monthly infusion to be sick still. So for 5 years, I was unable to walk very much. I had to use a cane. I was on about 5 opioids a day that I could pick from. It was like candy. I just had sort of this half life. And in 2015, I was thinking to myself, what happens to me when I'm 60? How many pills do I take when I'm 60 just to be able to like get up out of bed? And so I started looking for alternatives. And one of the alternatives that I kept coming across was actually CBD and cannabis. And so I flew to Denver on a whim. One of my friends took me to, it was a Woman Grow conference. And I went to the two things that I could get myself to go to with a cane hobbling. And I went to CBD and Me, and then another workshop around women of color in cannabis. And it changed my world. I decided that I was going to try to use CBD. I went to Harborside for CBD Angela, because I was in Oakland. I bought everything I could, THC, CBD, that I could afford. And I just started taking everything until I tried to figure it out. Because not a lot of people at that time knew how to treat lupus with cannabis. Do you know what I mean? And so it took me about 9 months, but I found my regimen. I stopped taking all 11 pills and I stopped the infusion. And I have been in remission for 5 years with the cannabis treatment since then, CBD and THC. And so that's what inspired me to open up with my friends, the People's Dispensary, because what was very true at the time is that I was in a lot of groups, chronically ill groups, lupus groups, women with lupus groups, people who are depressed because they have chronic illness groups. And what was true was that they were not using cannabis because there was such a stigma around it. And so I was well enough to go back into my old life. I was a tech person. I could make a lot of money. I was making a lot of money before I got sick. And I chose not to do that because it was so important to me to make sure that people in general, but specifically people of color who have been demonized around this drug and are afraid of it, understand that this actually is an alternative way to treat your illness that's holistic and doesn't put you addicted to opioids. And so that's really how we started.
Wow. I have to jump in for 1 second because I had not put that together for a second. When it comes to education around this plant, right, as alternative medicine and education around alternative medicine as a real and effective choice in your healthcare, that must be a struggle, especially for people who don't have access to doctors who are used to promoting that or who don't have the education around them to help promote that as a lifestyle, you know?
Patrick, I want you to imagine, I'm Mexican, so I want you to imagine that this is a medicine that's been used for centuries by Mexicans, right? Yeah. That then comes into the US and gets criminalized so that they can put people of color, brown people in jail. And
unreal, man.
There's a huge epidemic around drug use of actual drugs, like opioids, like crack cocaine, like actual drugs, right? And the one thing that could help you, that could save you, like it saved me because it literally saved me, is the one thing that you've been told since you were a child, don't do that or you will go to jail. Don't do that or they'll think you're lazy. Don't do that or they'll think you're a bad person. They'll think you're a war, you know, all the things that happen, all the stigmatization. And that is the one thing that you could actually use to save your life.
Wow. Well, and I guess it goes to show too that when it comes to how we educate our medical community and how we activate them as members of this community or tribe, as Steve likes to refer to us as, but when it comes to how those people are involved, you would think, hey, maybe prescriptions around something that is less diabolical, it's less, I guess habit inducing, you know, you have cannabis, you have alternative medicine, and there's a whole population that is not getting access to that, right? I mean, just my own humble point of view, but wow.
great point of view. It's a true point of view. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, like, I have 11 doctors. I have an endocrinologist, a nephrologist, a cardiologist. And for 5 years, I would go see them once a year, and they would re-up all my drugs. And I'd come in and I'd be sick. Like, I'd be so sick still. And then when I switched to cannabis, September of 2015 is when I stopped taking all of those medications, Lyrica, gabapentin, all of that stuff. So I see all my doctors in December. And so when I saw all 11 doctors in December, and I wasn't walking with a cane, and I looked like I had color in my face, and I didn't look like I was crouched over. They all asked me, they're like, what are you doing? And I said to them very plainly, I'm not taking the medications you prescribed.
Yeah, none of the shit you put
in. None of that stuff. Yes. This is what I'm taking. And I had half of them horrified that I was using cannabis as an alternative, and half of them were like, tell me more. And my primary physician actually started sending patients to me to get them off the opioids. And we had a lot of success with that. But I agree with you. It's really important that the doctors have our backs.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I had not thought of that before this moment. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I'll be the first to tell you that I've benefited from privilege my entire life. And, you know, I think it's very important that, you know, I say that not flippantly either. I think from my perspective, it's very important that everyone have access to mm-hmm. all options on the table when it comes to their health.
They have access without the fear of incarceration.
Yeah, well, of course.
That's that's access.
Like, it should be an of course, but even today in the legalized market, people are still getting busted. Like, they're still getting busted and put into prison. And so there's just so many levels of legalization and equitable access when it comes to cannabis. And it's not just about, do I have access, but do I have knowledgeable access so that I can treat the thing that hurts me in a way that's more holistic than what the doctor's going to give me, that's better than a Wellbutrin, or that's what, you know what I'm saying? Get rid of these synthetic medications. And I think that one of the reasons it's so hard is because the pharmaceutical companies are fearful that this would replace those things.
Yeah, of course. I mean, what Steve was talking about earlier about, you know, DuPont Chemical and how, hemp plastic was around. Henry Ford was trying to beat a hemp plastic car with a sledgehammer. It's been around for decades. But, hey, we still went to steel, aluminum, all this other kind of stuff and junk that we're putting in our bodies along the way. So I suppose let's circle this back around in the few minutes that we have left, Christine. The work that you're doing at the People's Dispensary, what are you seeing when it comes to social equity, especially across state lines? And what is it specifically you think we need to change right now?
Well, I can tell you social equity is not working in any state, including Illinois. And I'm really sad to say that, because in Illinois, we had high hopes because it's the first state that actually wrote social equity into the legislation. Mm. All of the other states are writing it in the back end, or they're statewide, or they're city specific. So I was really hopeful for Illinois, but of course that did not happen at all. And the reason that social equity doesn't work on a national level or a state level is because the way that it's being put together is by governments that have no intention of actually helping people of color. And I think that's important, because there's a lot of talk about social equity, but then when you go to get social equity, it's mostly white corporations that are still getting it using a black or brown face to get to that license. And then on the back end, you see that they have these terrible operating agreements with these folks in which they don't own anything by the end of the third year. And this is not anything new, but what is new is watching this happen in Illinois on a state level and state sanctioned. That is absolutely new. To say in Illinois, 21 companies are gonna buy for 75 licenses. Now they're trying to change that now. We'll see how they do, but that was their original intent. And almost only 13 of those 21 had people of color, but nobody knows what their actual ownership is going to be in 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. So social equity actually has to be built into the cannabis industry. The industry has to say, regardless of what governments say, we're going to be socially equitable. And so one of the things that you talked about before, which I thought was really interesting, is that there is a way to do that and still have a Cresco Labs. There is a way to do that and still have a Curaleaf. And the way that you do it is actually follow a CPG model, where you are able to have different brands underneath you that you don't change to a Curaleaf. You can go and buy this company owned by a black farmer and let him own a majority of his own company, like you see Louis Vuitton do and Hennessy do and PepsiCo do, and keep their brand. Because the thing that's happening right now that's awful is that they're trying to make it cookie cutter. They're trying to make it one group. There's going to be five. I've heard it said in all of these big conferences, there's only going to be 7 to 10 businesses. You know what? That's not who the cannabis community is. They don't want 7 to 10 businesses. They want a variety of businesses. We are a community that is going to be an industry. We're not the steel industry, the railroad industry. This is an industry that already existed. And so the reason that 7 out of 8 people in California still buy in the informal market is because we haven't, as an industry, or the larger industry, we figured it out as the people's dispensary, but the larger industry hasn't figured out, stop buying everything up and putting your name on it. Buy it up, be a holding of that, and help people create their own small businesses. You're still going to make a lot of money. Yeah. This is social equity, but it has to come from the cannabis industry. It cannot come from the governments, because look at the governments. They've never done anything that helped people of color. They just have never done that. You can't point to one governmental program that actually helps Black and Brown people.
Yeah,
you just can't. And so the industry has to take that up as a mantle. We have to decide. The Crescos, the Curaleafs, the Tilrays, all the big guys have to decide, this is actually worth doing and doing it right, in spite of all of the loopholes the state governments are going to give us or the federal governments are going to give us.
And I could not agree with you more. And I'm sorry to cut you off, but we are out of time. So I'll say this to close it out. You know, when it comes to those of us, especially in the media community, and I know, Javier, you'll probably echo this, but we want to shine the spotlight where it needs to be in this case. You know, we work with a lot of the big corporates, right? And we know what their strategies are for the most part. And we want to see them play out. I love hearing things from Al Harrington and other celebrities about, I want to create 100 Black millionaires in this industry. And we want to help see that through, right? It's very important to the industry as a whole that that happens. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
And as Christine says, I mean, here's the interesting part is like, study after study after study have demonstrated that diversity in the board, diversity in management, even diversity in the companies you acquire makes you more money. So even if your motivations aren't pure, I don't even care at this point. Like, here's the thing, Christine was saying, you go buy a Black owned company and it has all the Black swag, you know, the Latino swag, whatever. Why would you change it? I mean, as a company, thinking smartly, why would you like just dilute that and instead of at least maintaining that illusion of options for the consumer, right? So even if you're thinking about it from the worst of, you know, possible position, it will still make you money, right? And I'm not saying that's the real reason to do it. That's not my reason.
It's definitely a reason.
No,
reason that's better than
money talks. Yeah. And America loves money.
Money is power, whether you like it or not. And I think especially we're financial media, so we get it, you know, and we know what the game is. We're happy to shine the spotlight to make sure, you know, whether this is happening from a moral perspective, if we want to call it that, or not, it's an absolute necessity that it does happen.
And the industry will continue to lose money as long as it continues to try to do it this way. Money, they're going to continue to lose it. And I don't know I've been saying this for the last 3 years, and every year they have bad quarters, and I don't know when they're going to finally figure out that, hey, maybe this way is not the right way. Maybe there's other ways.
Well, come on, industry. Call Christine. Get it together.
So wait, before you leave, did you say you started consuming cannabis on September 20th, 2015?
No, I started in March of 2015. And by September, I was able to replace all my pills with cannabis instead.
So it's been 5 years this week. It's like your canniversary.
My canniversary. It's true.
Wow. Yeah,
we just did a partnership with Jane West, which is the founder of
Woman Grow.
And so we just did a partnership with her. And I thought, wow, this is just really full circle. Because I wouldn't be in this industry if I hadn't gone to that.
I love the line also. I gave my mother, who's like 72. I don't know if I should be saying this, but my mother is 72 and very posh. And I was like, you know what? Here's one of Jane West's accessories, like the one that looks like a makeup box.
Yes, yes.
She can hide it.
Mm-hmm.
That is a
powerful moment.
I love it.
Genius. That's
good.
Genius.
Good job, Mrs. Haas. Mm. You have done well. Well, listen, Christine, we really appreciate you joining us today. This has been one of my favorite shows. Just really, really good conversation all around. And it doesn't stop here. We all have goals. We all have ways that we can be active in seeing this stuff through. So, Christine, in the last minute that we have, how do people contact you? Where do they find you?
They can find me on all social media, the People's Dispensary, or at Miss Chris, MizChris.
Awesome. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Christine De La Rosa from the People's Dispensary. And we'll see you again soon, I hope.
Thanks.
All right. Have a good one.
You too.
So, Javi, we had a great show, man. This was good.
I love these. They're fun. They're entertaining. They're educational. They're conversational. Just, you know, I love it.
I gotta say this, and nobody really cares that I'm going to say this, but I'll say it anyway. You know, when it comes to a white guy in this industry, especially from a financial perspective, a financial media company, what's important to me is educating myself and helping educate others. I think there's still a large portion of the investment community that needs to be educated. I was on an email exchange with the chief investment officer of a very, very large hedge fund maybe a week or so ago. And he was telling me up and down that cannabis ruins people's lives and he's seen it firsthand. And he hopes even his own fund's investments in cannabis, he hopes fail, right? So it's that kind of mentality that we're all looking to change in one form or another, one way or another. And it's shows like this that get me excited, right?
We need information. It's like a few years ago, I had a friend down here in Argentina that also had lupus, and we always like tried to make it humorous with her to help her deal, cope. And Dr. Howe said, it's never lupus. So we joked, like, it's never lupus, it's never lupus. And she was like, well, in my case, it is. But, you know, that was her way to cope. And then someone suggested cannabis and we started saying, no, it's never weed. Like, weed is not medicine. This was several years ago and we didn't know this. And I mean, like several before I even got into the space, right?
Right.
And to date, that's like one of the leading searches down here. It's like, what is cannabis? People have no idea what it is, how it helps, how it can help them. You know, all they've heard is it's good. Now it's good. And it's not weed anymore. It's cannabis.
Wow.
I'll take it.
Yeah, no. I mean, listen, baby steps if we have to, but I think we're all ready to see some positive movement here. So with that, thank you folks for joining us today. We appreciate you hanging on 6 minutes past the hour. Thanks, Javier Haas, for joining me as always. Make sure to like and subscribe to this page and check out bzcannabis.com. for information on our next and last conference of the year on October 15th. I think there's still free tickets available. So head over there now.
Wow.
I know. Listen, we're trying to do our part. So grab them if you can and look forward to seeing you very soon. Stay safe. Thanks, everyone.
Three-day weekends are the stuff happiness is made of, especially when it's time for Haverty's July 4th sale, where literally everything is on sale. Sadly, every three-day weekend has to end eventually, but your new furniture will bring you happiness for years to come. Haverty's, we furnish happiness.
This episode is brought to you by Verizon. Get a Verizon Business Unlimited plan from the network businesses rely on. Hey, Monica, with 5G Ultra Wideband in many more cities, you get up to 10 times the speed at no extra cost.
Hello, downloads in no time.
Plus, unlimited premium data and hotspot data to keep the signal flowing and your teams going. Come in or book an appointment with a Verizon business expert to find the right plan for your team. 5G Ultra Wideband available in over 1,700 cities with Business Unlimited Pro 2.0 smartphone plan. Speed comparison is to median Verizon 4G LTE speeds. Download speeds may vary depending upon network and coverage conditions and content optimization for 5G Ultra Wideband.